From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Emily Tamkin, foreign affairs reporter at BuzzFeed News, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor of the National Journal. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard, Michael Warren.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un sent a letter to President Trump this week, coinciding with the return to the U.S. of what Kim claims are some of the remains of American soldiers who fought during the Korean War. But are the good feelings between the leaders obscuring a continued buildup of North Korea's nuclear program? Meanwhile, as internal tensions rise in Iran and the United States prepares to reinstate sanctions, President Trump offered to meet with President Hassan Rouhani with, quote, no preconditions. Tehran appears not to be taking the offer seriously, with the Iranian Navy reportedly beginning a major military exercise in the Persian Gulf. Back in the United States, former top Trump campaign official Paul Manafort's trial got underway this week. We'll talk about the federal government's case against Manafort, plus President Trump's renewed calls to end the special counsel investigation. And finally, Facebook says it's seeing signs the fake news influence campaigns from the 2016 elections are in full swing for the 2018 midterms. But we'll start with North Korea. And Emily, bring us up to speed. Do we know anything about this letter that President Trump announced he received from the North Korean leader, what it says, what it might mean? And is it correct that there seems to be a thawing of relations after I guess we're now 2 months after Singapore?
Well, we know that the letter coincided with the return of what we believe are American soldiers' remains from the Korean War. This was taken as a positive sign that we were moving in the right direction after the Singapore summit. But I think it's important to note that it also coincides with reports that North Korea is indeed moving ahead with its nuclear program. Secretary Pompeo, at a hearing last week in front of the full Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said that they are indeed still developing nuclear fuel. The report this week was with respect to a new missile. So yes, we know Trump was very touched by the letter because he right. tweeted it out, but we don't know that it actually means that North Korea is moving toward complete denuclearization. And the one other thing that I would add is that Trump and Secretary Pompeo continually say that we believe that he's moving toward denuclearization just like he agreed to do in the at the Singapore summit. That wasn't actually part of the written right. agreement, right? So we think that Kim Jong-un said that to Trump because Trump said that he did, and they just didn't have the time to get it down on paper. But this agreement that they keep referring to is not actually a written agreement that came out of Singapore, and it's unclear to me that the North Koreans are similarly viewing it as an agreement that came out of the Singapore summit.
Right. This always seems to be, Tom, a question of two different interpretations of words. In the case of the North Koreans, sort of a twisting of the language to their own conception, say, of what denuclearization is or what it means. And we still actually don't know for sure. The Pentagon, I believe, has not confirmed that these remains that are coming back, which is sort of the base level agreement from Kim to return these remains, that they are, in fact, what Kim claims they are. How, at this moment, can the American administration really believe anything that Kim says or that they're adhering to any sense of what the agreement was from Singapore?
Count me as a skeptic on this one, Michael. I've been to the demilitarized zone three times in my career, or maybe even four times. And I think on some level, there's a bromance going on here between President Trump and Chairman Kim for their own purposes. I think they both crave attention. They both crave functioning in the center ring, which is something that Kim has never been able to have happen in leading an isolated country, which for the most part remains a pariah in the world. So he needs the attention, and Trump needs the attention. Now, I don't mean to denigrate the Singapore meeting, but I do think the Singapore meeting was high on optics and a little murky on specifics. Question of these remains, it's going to take weeks and months. You can be sure the Pentagon is hoping to be able to get a DNA match with at least some of these remains, bones, basically.
Right.
The military has a joint identification facility in Hawaii that is very sophisticated, but it doesn't make judgments in 6 days. So we'll know about that soon enough. But this is a gesture. President Trump thanked Chairman Kim for his, Trump's word, kind gesture. But in the larger scale, I don't think the U.S. is any closer to denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula than it was before Singapore.
Right. And it seems, Emily, that the remains issue is sort of an easy one for Kim to meet, right? I mean, he can say that he sends these remains. The denuclearization part, this is something that goes to the heart of the North Korean state, its own conception of its national security and its sort of national identity. It always seemed that getting Kim to agree to this was going to be the hardest step. What do we know about this continued development of nuclear weapons, or at least nuclear resources that can be used in weapons? I was under the impression that the testing facility had been destroyed in North Korea. What's happening?
Right, which is why when everyone said, don't get so excited about this, you know, this high-profile destruction of a testing facility, it could mean that they don't need to test anymore. It could mean that this is just sort of what you can see.
Right.
And it's also why you're absolutely correct. You know, there's a reason that other presidents hadn't solved this issue, and that it is a complicated issue, which is why the South Koreans were so adamant that this was the beginning of a long process. It's why the Japanese were so wary about having the summit at all.
Right.
And it's why experts specifically on denuclearization were saying, wait a minute, there's no such thing as an expert on denuclearization, because there isn't one consensus on what that word means, right? So the North Koreans can turn around and say, yeah, we'll denuclearize after you stop all American activity in the Korean Peninsula, including the provision of aid, right? Which America's never going to agree to. So the consensus that formed around the summit was, well, diplomacy is always better than not diplomacy, so good, meet, but realize that this is the beginning of a long road and a long process. And the funny thing about this particular road is that it seems to have taken us back to where we were however many months ago of, what is it, strategic patience,
right?
So yeah, there's no rush to have them denuclearize is the White House line now, and that's fine. But what are the diplomatic steps that you're taking to move toward that point, since it wasn't one and done at the Singapore summit?
Right. Strategic patience, of course, was the Obama administration doctrine toward North Korea, which the Trump administration said they were going to revisit and really sort of overthrow. Returning to that is an interesting development with North Korea. One other potential nuclear power that the Trump administration is definitely veering away from the Obama administration on is with Iran. We have tensions, political tensions within Iran. Last week, there was an exchange, Tom, between Hassan Rouhani, who blasted the United States and blasted President Trump. President Trump responded with a tweet that was in all caps, that was essentially threatening Iran if it was going to do anything to threaten the United States, that they would be hit back. And now this week, the president is asked at a press conference if he would meet with Hassan Rouhani, the president of Iran, with no preconditions. And President Trump said, yes, he would. Is a meeting really in the offing here?
I wouldn't hold your breath on that one, Michael. I think this is just a ploy. The president's views on Iran are very clear. He opposed the nuclear deal, and he, in spite of the other five members of the group, mainly from Europe, he's going to pull out. He says, and I can't imagine that this is going to happen. I'm not sure why he did that, other than the fact that he uses a possible meeting with the Iranians as a way, kind of psychologically, to buttress the value of his meeting with Kim and his meetings with Vladimir Putin. It's good to talk. I mean, and who could be against that?
Right.
But I don't think this is going to happen. I mean, he has no use for them. He thinks they're violating the treaty. They think, to go back to an earlier war, they think he's the great Satan in another context. And so I'd be very, very surprised.
But there are these tensions in Iran right now, Emily. There's the strain of economic sanctions, or expected economic sanctions, that are going to be coming back because of the precision of the Iran deal. This could be a moment in Iran where there could be a possible political change, but it seems that the regime itself is maintaining its very sort of aggressive stance. We have this major Iranian naval exercise starting now, the United States is saying, in the Persian Gulf. Where do things stand right now, given what we expect will be some very tough economic times for Iran coming forward? Is there any chance that Iran could decide to come back to the table with not President Obama, but President Trump?
There's always a chance. What I think is interesting is that there were protests in Iran earlier this year before the United States had withdrawn from the JCPOA when economic conditions hadn't improved and the Iranian regime couldn't blame the wider world, right? So they themselves had to take accountability. So, you know, if what you, the United States or any foreign power is trying to do is hope for political change in Iran, I'm not sure that giving the Iranian regime an obvious foreign scapegoat is the, you know, right course of action, but it's the one that they took. Sure, at some point, maybe Iran will come back to the table, but I thought their response to Trump's offer or suggestion that he would meet with no preconditions was really interesting. Foreign Minister Zarif also got on Twitter and said, we talked, right? We did talk. We talked for years, and that the product of that, the end result of that, was the JCPOA, which worked, which you pulled out of, and what we're not going to do is have you, you know, pretend that you're the ones who got us back to the table and you're the ones who got us a better deal. No, we agreed to a deal. You're the ones who broke it. Why would we talk again?
Right. Is there a possibility that the Europeans would not eventually, they'll come kicking and screaming, but they'll eventually abide by the Trump administration's pulling out and reinstating sanctions? There's obviously some economic upside to the Europeans doing business in Iran. There's business there that they've wanted to engage in for years now. Is there a possibility that that Donald Trump and the Trump administration could threaten to pull back economic activity with our European allies if they don't also reinstate these sanctions? Where does that stand?
Yeah, I mean, the Trump administration already has threatened our European allies in a way in that they've said, we expect you to get to zero crude oil imports from Iran by November 4th. Not work your way toward there, but you're at zero. They've sort of walked that back a little bit since a senior State Department official made that announcement and said there might be some exceptions. But the idea of pulling out of the Iran deal was that you would then somehow convince your allies to work with you to create a better deal. It's going to be very difficult for the Europeans, right? Because they were so adamant about the fact that the deal was working, right, and that the United States should stay in it, that the deal did not belong to any one country, that they would not be bullied, that it was their choice to remain in the Iran deal. On the other hand, you know, it's up to European companies, and they're realistically, they do more business with the United States than they do with Iran. The only other point that I would make is that the Europeans are not the main importers of Iranian oil. The oil imports are the big moneymaker for Iran in this, right? So what the Europeans may try to do is bring it down to some smaller amount, get the exemption or the exception, and somehow work it out such that India, for example, a big importer of Iranian oil, is still able to work with Iran.
Well, we'll be obviously following both of these stories, but we're going to take a quick break and return with more issues in just a moment.
You're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America from Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Emily Tamkin, foreign affairs reporter at BuzzFeed News, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor of the National Journal. Our moderator is Michael Warren, White House correspondent for The Weekly Standard.
Welcome back. Tom, Paul Manafort's trial in federal court began this week. Give us a synopsis of what happened with this former Trump campaign official, top Trump campaign official, who's now under the thumb of the federal government.
Right. Manafort, who was President Trump's campaign manager for about 4 months or so in 2016, has been charged, I think, on around 18 counts of bank fraud, financial fraud, wire fraud, money laundering, all sorts of things. And the one thing that you haven't heard in the courtroom so far is any references to the alleged scandal that President Trump finds himself fighting the war with Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller. This is an offshoot of information learned in the course of that investigation. But the charges against Manafort are basically money laundering, having nothing to do with the Trump campaign. But the prosecutors so far, and the prosecutors always get to go first. We'll have to see what the defense counters with when they have their time. But the prosecutors are laying out quite a breathtaking case of spending on rugs and homes and overseas apartments, and one exhibit was a $15,000 ostrich coat that Manafort bought. He was allegedly a big spender, spending a lot of money, and his former bookkeeper was a prosecution witness, and she said basically he ran through everything we had at some point, and we were down to not making sure we had enough money to pay for employee health insurance. And so the prosecutors have said the money crunch that Manafort had after all these decades of huge spending was why he did some of the things that he is alleged to have done.
Right, and those are the work that Manafort was doing, and the connection here to the Russian interference and possible Trump campaign involvement in that is Manafort's work before joining the Trump campaign and possibly during the Trump campaign for Ukrainian political interests that were aligned with Vladimir Putin and Russia. Emily, we heard, listening to Tom discuss the crimes that Paul Manafort is being prosecuted for, the president compared him to Al Capone, the famous 1930s gangster who ended up being caught up on tax evasion for a lot of crimes that were much more violent, and really tax evasion was the way that the federal government went after Capone. It was an interesting comparison. The president used this as a way to claim that Manafort was being treated unfairly. Oh, and by the way, this entire investigation by the special counsel is a giant hoax and a witch hunt. Same kind of language we've heard, or has it been heightened this week with Manafort on trial?
Oh, I think it's been heightened this week. I mean, it's the same refrain, but at a louder volume, right? And the irony of the Capone comparison is that he was saying, look how, who was treated worse, this horrible man, Al Capone, or Paul Manafort, who's a respected political operative. First of all, why would you compare this man you believe to be innocent to Al Capone? Just like keep it, like don't put them in the same sentence or same tweet. Second of all, as you say, the irony here is that despite all these other horrible things that Al Capone did, they got him on tax evasion, much like Manafort is now on trial for tax fraud and money laundering. So, you know, I think it's widely believed that the reason that Manafort is on trial is that there is some hope from the special counsel that this will put pressure on Manafort such that he says something about Trump. We know that Manafort worked not just in Ukraine, but worked for Viktor Yanukovych, under whom Ukraine pulled away from an EU association agreement and turned back toward Russia, which ushered in the Maidan revolution. We know, according to the bookkeeper, that Manafort's business was losing money around the time that he joined the Trump campaign. So I think that the hope is that you'll put these things together, you'll scare this guy basically into thinking that he will finally face some consequences for his alleged actions, and that that will lead to something on the Trump collusion
case.
Well,
now Paul Manafort's business partner, Rick Gates, has also been brought up on these charges, and he's now flipped. He has now become a witness for the federal government, Tom. But I agreed with Emily that there was this sense that Manafort would have the squeeze put on him and would flip as well. He hasn't done that yet. How can we interpret the fact that we are now in trial here?
To be cynical about it, you have to wonder whether Manafort is holding out hope for a presidential pardon. I have no way of knowing that, of course. None of us do, with the possible exception of the president. But given all the charges that Manafort has been brought up on, if even a handful of these charges result in a conviction, he could be sent away to prison for pretty much the rest of his life. So you have to ask yourself, maybe it's just as simple as there's a jury of 12 peers. All you need is one of those people who loves President Trump,
right,
who's an honest person but loves President Trump and thinks that anybody involved with the president is being treated poorly and would vote not guilty. I'd love to know what the jury selection experts are saying about the composition of this jury. So, I mean, in the meantime, Manafort's legal bills go up and up and up and up. And so he's either going to need a deal with the prosecutors or a pardon from the president.
Right. Well, we'll be following this. And as you mentioned earlier, Tom, the defense has yet to present its own case. But while we're on the subject of the 2016 elections and Russian meddling, we saw from the White House a number of top law enforcement and homeland security and national security officials, the national security advisor John Bolton, the FBI director Chris Wray, a number of other officials, all stood up from the at the podium at the White House to say that they are part of a presidential appointed task force, essentially, to go after foreign meddling, including from Russia, in the 2018 midterm elections. This comes at a time, Emily, that Facebook is saying publicly that those fake news elements that influenced the 2016 campaign are in full swing in 2018. What did we learn this week about what's happening with these elections just a few months away?
There's three things that I think we learned this week. One, to crib from my colleague, Kevin Collier, who wrote about this for BuzzFeedNews.com, it was clear watching the press conference yesterday that it was not clear who exactly is in charge here, right? So as you say, we heard from the FBI, DHS, NSA, but who is coordinating and taking responsibility for election meddling in the midterm elections?
Well, the officials said that President Trump himself directed these people to make this a top priority. Isn't it not the president?
But the president is not, and Senator Warner, who is sort of number two on the Senate.
The Democratic senator, yep.
Made the point yesterday that normally you would have someone in the White House coordinating these people in the day-to-day level, right? Making sure that they were all working together or in concert or toward this common goal. President Trump himself cannot be that person, just practically, logistically, and, you know, given what he said about Russian alleged electoral meddling, it might not be appropriate for him to be the person to try to stop it.
Well, Tom, we've talked about how the president himself has not been really willing to get out there and say that Russia did in fact meddle. He's sort of waffled a bit on that, saying it could have been other countries as well. And at the same time, there's a cognitive dissonance to hear from the president's top aides say that it did happen. Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, say it did happen in 2016, and it's very possible that the similar things could be happening right now in 2018. To Emily's point, who is in charge on this effort?
It's hard to know, although National Security Advisor John Bolton sent a letter in recent days to Congress saying, I'm coordinating and we'll keep you posted. But it's just the whole thing is very strange. I've been around the White House a long time, and I've never seen that quantity of senior officialdom, five top officials of the government all saying the same thing. The Russians did it. They did it in 2016 in hopes of influencing the election and destabilizing democracy, and they're doing it again. The Secretary of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, said American democracy is in the crosshairs right now, and all of their language was much starker and much more direct than anything we've heard from the president. So it's just kind of a disconnect, and I think it should be worth noting the president went off a few hours later to Pennsylvania for one of his Make America Great Again rallies, and he referred to the Russian business as a hoax, a giant hoax, which is one of his previous refrains as well. So that's your question remains unanswered, Michael, which is, you know, who's in charge here?
Well, it is a very odd development to have the president sort of denying what his own advisors have been telling him privately and publicly. I think it was another thing to see it in the White House. We had heard things from, for instance, Dan Coats at separate events outside of Washington, where he was apparently reprimanded by the president for leaning forward on the theory, which is really fact, has been proven, as the intelligence agencies have found, that Russia interfered in the 2016 election. So to hear it at the White House, from the White House podium, was certainly interesting. We're going to have to leave it there for the week. That's all the time we have. Thanks to Emily Tamkin, foreign affairs reporter at BuzzFeed News, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor of the National Journal. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Warren, White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.